And of course, we'll take your phone calls now as we talk about Rick Delano's work, The Principal, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Rick Delano with us. Rick, we'll get to these calls. So let's go all the way back to the beginning for a moment. The Copernican Principle, what is it?
It's very simple. The Copernican Principle states that the Earth is not in any special, privileged, or otherwise central location in the universe, and therefore, we are not in any way special or privileged observers of the universe.
And I think we might be.
I do too.
How come your voice is dark, deeper than mine?
I think it might have something to do with the fact that we're coming up on the wee hours here, and I'm usually pretty early to bed, early to rise.
Where are you from? Where were you born, by the way?
I was born in Greenwich, Connecticut, grew up in Illinois, and then Colorado.
Okay.
And that's where I did that star thing. And then I moved to Los Angeles in 1980, which makes me, I mean, technically almost a native by now.
Sure, it is. And you wanted to get into the film industry.
Well, actually,
and entertainment.
The funny part is I had no interest in the film industry at all. I was in the music business for a long time. I made my living as a session musician, independent producer. And
bet you met them all, too, didn't you?
No, I met a lot of just incredible people. I mean, what's really interesting is the most talented, the most freakishly, wildly talented artists that I ever encountered never made it. Nobody ever heard of
it. Never made it?
They never made it. And it's just weird to me because I think back to, you know, I mean, I met people who became huge. I mean, I'll never forget, we were rehearsing one day just up behind the whiskey in a garage of all places. And I saw these people walking up the street, and I thought that they were like mutants or from another planet or something. And 2 years later, those guys were Motley Crue. They were the biggest band in the world.
That's right. That is fantastic. You know, we know Billy Gibbons real well from ZZ Top. Great guy.
What a guitar player
he is. One of the best. He may be the best alive right now.
You know, I tell you, there are very few guitar players who you can listen to 3 seconds and know exactly who they are. Yeah. Billy is one of them.
Well, you know what he still says, too? He says, still same 3 chords.
When you've got a voice like his, man, where just every note he plays is like, that's Billy Gibbons. I wouldn't bother with it.
Well, and guess who just emailed us when you were on?
Who?
John Fogerty.
Oh, man, John Fogerty. There's another one. What a songwriter he is. Dear God.
I love it. All right, let's take some calls for you. And you're not a physicist. Let's qualify that. But you're pretty darn close.
Yeah, I'm a filmmaker. That's all I am.
You're probably an honorary scientist or something.
I just was crazy enough to imagine that that we could make a really interesting film by talking to the most interesting minds.
Let's go to St. Louis first. Derek's with us on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Derek.
Morning, guys. And George, I was hoping maybe you could lean on Rick a little bit, and after his movie succeeds in Texas, you could get him to bring it here to St. Louis.
Oh, that would be great. And I would introduce it for you, Rick, in St. Louis when I go back there.
Hey, guess what? We're just going to have to get it out there in that case.
We'll do it.
Absolutely. Hey, I've got late hours. Obviously, I'm just now getting off of work. And AMC, on occasion, shows a movie. It was done in the 50s about the cosmos. But it's a movie that they were teaching children in school. And I've only caught it during the middle and end of the movie, but some of the things that they were teaching as fact in that movie is just unbelievable. Like they saw what they thought was trees and vegetation on Mars, and they were fully confident that there was forest growing on Mars, which nowadays you tell somebody that, they think you're crazy.
Exactly.
I can't wait to watch your movie because you just go 60 years out, and the things they're teaching today that are facts are going to be disproved in our lifetimes.
That's absolutely true, and the thing is, that's the beautiful thing about science. You know, science is about testing and re-examining what we think we know. The problem is that if you turn science into a religion, you have not done yourself a favor and you have not done science a favor. Because if you wait, just like you say, wait 60 years, it's all going to change.
You think, Rick, I would guess that this universe is teeming with intelligent life.
It is absolutely certain to be teeming with intelligent life. If the Copernican principle is true. This is why basically every scientist is absolutely certain that there's life everywhere in the cosmos. The problem is, and we talked about this earlier, there's real issues now. I mean, we've had SETI going for, good Lord, almost 50 years now. When they first brought SETI to Congress, they had an equation called the Drake equation.
That's right.
And they put the Drake equation, they said, you fund us, and by X number of years, we're going to look at X number of parsecs of the sky, and this equation tells us that we're overwhelmingly likely to bump up against at least, you know, a few civilizations. Well, we haven't. And that's a problem. And if you want to look into this from the other side of the coin, it's called Fermi's paradox, after Enrico Fermi, the great atomic scientist who worked on the Manhattan Project, was famous for building an atomic reactor on a squash court in Chicago. Brilliant guy. He is the guy who first realized this paradox. If life is teeming everywhere in the cosmos, some of that life has been teeming for billions of years. Where is everybody? So it is certainly very plausible, since we're now seeing evidence of perfectly good planets for life, very plausible. You would expect, if we're nothing special, that life would be everywhere. On the other hand, if we are actually as special as some of the recent observations would tend to suggest, maybe not.
In the principle, do you look at time?
Absolutely we do. As a matter of fact, one of the brilliant theorists in the film is a fellow by the name of Julian Barber. I have to tell you, when we went to Yale, where we got a lot of these interviews at a Yale conference, and Julian has this remarkable theory, actually, where he doesn't believe in time. He doesn't believe time is real. He believes that time is just a fiction that our brain tells us to explain movement. He thinks that what's real is movement, and that time is sort of like the same kind of an illusion that you get when you go into a movie theater. They project a bunch of still frames, and it gives the illusion of continuity and motion. So Julian was up there trying to explain this theory, and George Ellis, of course, who's also in the film, and they're very good friends, George Ellis stands up and says, Julian, excuse me. You're telling me there's no time. Can you please explain that? And Julian says, well, and he says, no, I'm sorry, you can't wave your hand like that. You can't wave your hand because that's time. It was just funny to see these guys going at it. If you get them, you know, behind closed doors and with their ties down, the battles these guys fight are just wonderful to watch.
Yeah, they are. Do you think time travel will be possible?
I don't, and the reason is that I don't believe that we have the correct theory of time. I don't believe that the current theory of time, or what we call space-time, is derived from Einstein's equations, and the idea is that, you know, we don't have space on its own, and we don't have time on its own. The two are together as an entity. Now, I personally think that that's going to fall. I can't say when, but I think we are seeing indications that that model of reality is running up against some problems. I do, however, believe, because remember, I'm a theist. I'm a believer in a created cosmos. I believe that we have something beyond time. I believe that we have a much richer reality, in a sense, that is not bound to the linear progression of time. But I don't think that we can take that linear progression of time and reverse it. Just my opinion.
Deja vu? Real or not?
I think it's a spiritual faculty. I think that we are eternal beings, and I believe that we do have the capability of making a connection outside of time. Visionaries have always been able to, prophets, you know, there are very profoundly powerful prophecies through history. These guys are obviously tapping into something. They certainly weren't doing it with a math equation. They were tapping into something. I believe that it is possible for us to access that realm that exists beyond and outside of time under the right conditions.
Jim is in San Diego. He's now on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, yeah, good evening. Nice. Yeah, you guys are really like, it's, you know, there's a scientific point of view, and there's a, you know, religious of view, you know, of just about everything. And then there's us in the middle, and most of us would just like a simple answer from the so-called experts from each side. And science has shown it's not perfect. A lot of so-called eminent scientists of the past have been proven wrong by new discoveries. And so I don't think science nowadays is just not equipped enough, has the right approach, or yes, a goal of science. The goal of science is to prove that things exist or certain theories, but yes, how do you reconciliate both of those, you know, so we can just get some answers? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's the middle ground between each side is missing, and it's really, you know, we always want the right answers, but we're just not getting the answers that the more answers we get, the more questions they bring up. So it's a pretty tricky issue, and dealing with it, you know, is really important. So anyway, I'll just listen on the air and have a good evening.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much. He raises an excellent point. What we really want from science and from religion is a picture of reality that works. What we really want is to be able to tell our kids, when our kids start asking us, why, Mommy, why, Daddy? We want to tell them something that they can rely on. We want to have a solid foundation underneath us when we start asking these why questions. And that's what both science and religion are for. Now, remember, at the beginning, they're the same thing. This division between faith and science is a very recent phenomenon. And that middle ground that we all instinctively feel is missing is really the result of that divorce between faith and science, which really begins with, you know, the Galileo trial. That was the first time where science stood up and said, hey, we have a way of knowing reality that is superior to the religious and theological way of knowing reality. And that was a divorce, in a sense. But at the end of the day, where does science come from? Really, science comes into being as a developed method in one civilization at one time, the Enlightenment.
Was there anybody in the principle that defined the universe and what it is and how it is?
Yeah.
That you really just said they're spot on.
Oh, yeah, I had to be very, very careful to keep my personal views on this as much, in the background as possible. Because,
well, it's not easy to do that.
It's not, but I wanted to make sure that the audience got exposed to every one of these profound ideas about reality. Now, Max Tegmark is really brilliant, guy, and a wonderful thinker. And he's about as far away from me as it's possible to get. He's an atheist. He believes in the multiverse. He is absolutely convinced that the multiverse is an actually existing thing. But when you look at him in the film, he is so convinced now that we are so special in the universe. He believes we're the only intelligent life in the entire, not just our galaxy. He's convinced that we're the only.
See, and I'm just totally opposite that.
Exactly.
I think it's
and of course, there are other guys in the film who would be closer to you. But Max strikes me as very interesting because you would think, with his atheist formation and viewpoint and his commitment to the Copernican principle, that he would sit right on that side of the tracks. He sits completely on the other side. So I found that to be a very, very interesting aspect. In my opinion, we are on the verge, and I think that within our lifetimes, we will have a different physics and a different cosmology than the Big Bang and general relativity.
Well, we may need to.
I think that we do. We've reached dead ends. Once we start talking about a multiverse, that can never be observed. How can that possibly be a correct outcome of the scientific method when it can never be observed or tested or measured in any way? I think we are at a very crucial fork in the road for science.
Steve, Cameron, New York, first-time caller. Welcome to the show. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a great program. Fascinating.
Thank you.
My question for Rick is this. I'm just a layman, so I don't know the facts exactly, but from our vantage point, let's say, for argument's sake, we can only see 10 million light years in any direction, but the universe exceeds our range of vision. Won't we always appear to be the center?
Okay.
Because our range of vision is equidistant from our standpoint.
That's a brilliant point. He is absolutely right. And this is exactly the argument that Stephen Hawking makes, which is that it looks like we're in the center, of course, but that's just because the universe is bigger than we can observe, and the light only has a certain amount of time to reach us. So obviously, we look like we're in the center of the universe. That's a very compelling argument, except we have now seen all the way out to the cosmic microwave background, the leftover radiation from the Big Bang itself, it is said. There is nothing beyond that that we can ever even theoretically see. This is important. We're the first generation that has seen out as far as it is possible, theoretically, to see. Now, you can say, well, there's a bunch of universe that we can't see. That's very possible. But how can that ever be an object of science? How can we possibly do science on domains that we can never access? It's a question that I think is important, because if science is about what we can observe and test and measure, it's kind of ironic to have our equations leading us into multiverses and domains that we can never access. If that's true, then science has come up against the limits of its powers, and we'll just have to turn back to philosophy and metaphysics. On the other hand, if the Copernican principle is false, then what we're seeing with our eyes is actually the way things actually are. And that possibility, I think, is going to get a lot more attention in the years to come.
We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with Rick Delano, and we're going to take final phone calls. His work is called The Principle. His website, theprinciplemovie.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. As for us, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, and you can do all that by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Emailing me is easy, as so many of you have been doing tonight, george@coasttocoastam.com, george@coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take calls from Florida, state of Washington, Canada, back to St. Louis again, California, and the rest of the world on Coast to Coast AM. Just tuning in, of course, Rick Delano, our special guest, as we talk about his work, The Principle. And when we come right back, we will wrap things up by taking final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Rick Delano as we wrap up things, talking about his film, The Principle. How long does it run, Rick?
It's a 90-minute run.
Okay.
I could have made it 5 hours, but I thought I'd just give you one chance to look at it. It's a tough film. Requires a lot from the audience, but I truly believe that there's an audience out there that's ready to grapple with
this. You know, when these scientists say they were tricked, what did they mean by that? I mean, did they feel the editing was changed on them, or what?
Well, that's what they felt, but it's a little difficult because none of them saw the film, and none of the people who told them they were tricked had seen the film. What really happened here is that a very clever fella who had it in for the executive producer, tweeted Lawrence Krauss and Michio Kaku, told him, hey, you guys have been tricked. You've been edited and misedited. That makes you sound like... And the problem is that once that story started to roll, nobody bothered to pick up the phone and call me. I would have been happy.
Yeah, that's what you're saying. That would be the logical thing to do.
Yeah, but if the agenda really is to shut the film down before... Look, I have amazing interviews in the film. I asked questions that nobody else asked. And because, you know, some people were very uncomfortable with the idea that they were going to be painted as dupes or painted, you know, edited into saying things that they didn't actually say. I guess the story just got so big so fast that they felt that they had to disassociate themselves from the film, which I think in the long run is going to really turn out to have been a mistake. I have to tell you, There are a lot of really good guys, friends of mine, that basically tossed me under the bus when that story hit.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Now the film is out there, and people can see it, and they're going to be able to see that those stories are simply not true.
Gary in Tampa, Florida, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
George, I just wanted to mention one quick thing to you. I'd like to congratulate you on changing the policy of being able to call more than once a month. I've talked to you probably, I don't know, 20 times or so, and I've got a lot of knowledge on certain subjects, more than the average person. I've gone to United States Naval Nuclear Power School. I'm a student of politics, of the Constitution, and you've had many, many shows when I would, you know, try to call in to offer, you know, some suggestions and points, and your call screeners are good. They said, Gary from Tampa, didn't you call a couple weeks ago? Listen, Gary, you got to wait a month. So I really appreciate you relaxing that, because I think your call screeners do a great job, and if you got a good question or a good comment, they're going to let you through. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I think that was very good. I wanted to, Mr. Delano, am I saying that right?
That's right.
Okay. I wanted to, I mean, it's a fascinating talk, and I like what you've been saying, but I want to offer that you have contradicted yourself at least twice, and then I want you to kind of tell me why am I wrong. Now, I'm going to base what I'm saying tonight on epistemology. Now, the definition of epistemology is essentially the study of knowledge. In other words, how do you know what you know? And there's only two ways to know something. The first is directly through your own experience, or indirectly through someone else's experience, them telling you, you're reading about it. And each of those are flawed. For instance, a quick example of through your own experience. In December of 1978, a red panda, also called a lesser panda, escaped from a zoo in Rotterdam, Holland. And so the zoo put out to the newspapers that this red panda has escaped, and they want to try to get the public's, you know, input so they can find it and get it and get it back. Now, red pandas are very rare animals. They're indigenous to China, Tibet, Nepal, and Burma, not Holland. And they are very distinctive in appearance and cannot be mistaken for any other animal. Right at the time that the zoo put the information out, they discovered the panda quite dead on some railroad tracks adjacent to the zoo.
Huh.
But yet over 100 sightings came in that said that different people observed the panda alive, when in fact it was obvious that he was dead. And these reports didn't quit until several days after the papers.
And he was the only panda out there.
Right, and it's a very rare panda. So even someone's experience or observing something is inherently flawed in many, many cases. And the same thing with indirect knowledge. How do you know that Mount Everest is the tallest mountain? I doubt any of us right here have ever been there. We certainly probably haven't measured it. So we accept that it's the tallest mountain because
we're told that.
Right, but we're told it from an authoritative source, and so we accept it. But
right.
We don't know for sure, okay? So based on that, Mr. Delano, you made a statement using the Copernican theory that we are in the center of the universe.
Right, and keep in mind, he's not a physicist, just the film producer.
I understand, but he's making some very good points. I mean, he's obviously studied.
Oh, sure.
Now, let me tell you why I think the Copernican theory, the way he explained it, is incorrect. Because you say that the Copernican theory says that the Earth is essentially not special, our location is not special. And so what he's doing is he's using one assumption to support a second assumption that, well, if the Earth's not special, its location is not special, then the human beings on it aren't special. I don't see how one can justify the other. It doesn't mean just because the location of the Earth isn't special that humans aren't very special, very unique, and are, very rare to unique in the entire universe. So you use that to say that we are in the central part of the universe. In fact, the previous caller or two made a great point when he said, if you want to see 10 million light years, it's going to appear that you're in the center. Now, you acknowledged in your own words that we don't know what the perimeter of the universe is. We don't know where the edges are. So if you acknowledge that you don't know where the edges are or the perimeter, you can't possibly make a statement that we're in the center. So that's the first one. Tell me why I'm wrong there. And
okay,
then...
Well, that,
all right, let's get this first, Gary. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Gary. I would say, first of all, that I tried to make it very clear, and if I didn't, I want to now, to make the point that science deals with what we can observe, test, and measure, and experiment upon. When science trains its instruments of observation on the cosmos, we see a lot further than 10 million light years. We see 13.8 billion light years in all directions. And the point I tried to make was that we have now observed as far as it will be possible for us to observe. We have seen what they call the surface of last scattering, the first light in the universe from the Big Bang. If there is anything beyond that, we will never see it. The light will never reach us. So my point was that the observable universe, the universe that is an object of the scientific method, we have seen it. Anything beyond that, we will never be able to observe. So my point is that based on an observable universe, we're certainly at the center. It's certainly also true that if the observable universe is not all the universe, we cannot speak of a perimeter. My point is that science can only deal with what we can observe.
All right, and let's grab your second quick question, Gary, and then we got to move on. Go ahead, Gary.
I'm going to forego my second question, and I want to offer you a question, an answer, George. You said that it's hard for you to understand how something can be created out of nothing.
Yes.
Well, simply put, nothing or zero is the natural, most stable state in the universe. In order for something to exist, the opposite has to exist. For instance, matter, you have to have an equal amount of antimatter, energy, an equal amount of negative energy. In other words, things have to have the absolute value of each other. So if they come together, they annihilate send each other back to zero. So that's how something is created. Out of nothing, it's created by having the absolute values of each other, and that's why there's matter and there's antimatter. And you know, I just wanted to offer that as an answer to your question and get your opinion of it. Great show, George. Coast to Coast is so unique and so important. Thank you for continuing to do this. I'll get off and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay, you're great. What about that? Nothing.
Okay, no, I don't agree with Gary on this second point, because he said that it's the balance between matter and antimatter. Well, antimatter is a thing, and matter is indisputably a thing. Those are not nothings. Those are two somethings. And this is a crucial little, in my opinion, a dipsy-do that we are seeing more and more coming from the theorists, because, in my opinion, they want to come up with a way to have a universe created without a creator. It's not nothing. Matter is a something. Antimatter is a something. The fact that they are in balance has nothing to do with them becoming nothing or having been nothing at any point along the way. They are both somethings. They must be accounted for. Matter exists. It cannot have brought itself from non-existence into existence. The mere fact that it balances with something else does not mean that it came from nothing.
Next up, we go to Andy in Long Beach, and that's in Washington, I guess. Right, Andy?
Yes, it is. Good evening.
Okay, hi there.
Yes, I'm 54. I've been an observer of the skies all my life, a self-taught astronomer, and I love physics, astrophysics, quantum physics, as much as I can keep up with it. It's obvious to me that we still have a lot to learn about what's out there. Dark energy, dark matter, we don't know what that is. I think there's many elements and possible, forces of the universe that we have not discovered yet, in light and gravity and different things like that. If we're going to blow away Copernican theory, how is it that I've lived my life on this planet watching us launch rockets at an ever-increasing pace to more ambitious missions all the time without having an understanding, complete understanding of the mechanics of our solar system when we make calculated flight plans? That is a mathematical and scientific method, and there should or there verify the Copernican theory, in my mind.
Okay. Well,
if we didn't understand it, we couldn't go. We couldn't do that.
Okay, I appreciate the point. It's simply not true. The claim that these calculations can only be made from one particular reference frame is false. We know it to be false. It is false because the attempt to establish that idea of an absolute frame failed for two centuries. And finally, at the end of the 19th century in 1887, it was definitively established that all attempts to directly measure the motion of the Earth that you are absolutely convinced is occurring, and everybody else was too, could not be directly demonstrated. Now, this provides physics with a problem. It means either that the Earth is not going around the sun, or it means that the Newtonian physics that you are so confident prove that we couldn't get to Mars or we couldn't get to the moon unless that physics was true, but it doesn't. And Albert Einstein was the guy who pointed this out. He said, you know what? It is absolutely impossible by any operation of physics to establish an absolute frame. If general relativity is true, the math has to be doable no matter what you take as the center of the solar system. And this is shocking to people, but it is the foundational assumption of general relativity itself. There are no absolute frames. The math might be easier in one particular frame, but that no more proves that it's an absolute frame than if I were to be a navigator and I were to say, hey, you know what? I can sail my boat from New York to London based on the assumption that geocentrism is true. It's just the easier frame for doing the calculations. Also, it's important to understand that navigation software that controls NASA deep space probes and GPS, the entire calculation is done in a geocentric frame because it's easier. It doesn't prove an absolute frame. So if just because the calculations are easier if we make certain assumptions, it does not in any way, shape, or form mean that we have established the calculations couldn't be done from another frame.
St. Thomas, Canada. We've got James on the international line now. Let's get a few more in. Go ahead, James.
Yes, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I just want to make a couple comments. First of all, I just want to say that mankind is not the highest on the food chain because of evolution, but because he's made in the image and likeness of God. And to me, scientifically, that would make more sense. And also, if you think about where is science going and where are we going to go with science? Because, see, a lot of people think that science debunks God, debunks the creator. But there's, the more we explore, the more we invent, there's no possible way that we're going to go backwards. We're only going to go forwards to the creator. That's my comment. Thank you.
Well, he might be spot on, Rick.
He won't get any argument out of me. I am absolutely convinced that the application of the scientific method is leading us inexorably toward a recognition of the necessity of an intelligent design, of a creator of the universe. That's my personal opinion.
What would be, for you, the most astounding thing you learned from doing your own work, the principle?
The axis of evil. It is so astounding. It is just it's even hard for people to believe that when you actually look at this 40 billion light year radius cosmos, that the largest structures that we see out there are organizing themselves along a preferred direction that's pointing at us.
Are they alive?
Well, we don't know. All I can tell you is that the largest objects, the largest structures that we see are preferentially pointing out a preferred direction across the universe, and we're on it.
and we happen to be the only people that we know of that can build the telescopes to have noticed.
It has got to be one of the most astounding questions ever, and that simply is, why are we here?
I can tell you what I think. I think we are here to know, to love, and to serve God in this life.
That's far from what a physicist would say.
That's true. But I also will say that there are many physicists who would agree, and I think that the next generation and the generation after that, look, the greatest scientific discoverers in history were all believers. Newton, Galileo, Copernicus himself, all of them.
All of them, indeed. Rick, thanks for being on the program.
George, thank you.
You're welcome. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.